From Northeast Public Radio, this is The Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score. Killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
Media Project is an opportunity for us to give a half hour of commentary and analysis, and some weeks when we're on our game, even a little bit of insight into the news media issues of the week. So welcome to the show. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union here. Our producer, Dave Gustina, is just going to give maybe insight, maybe not a little insight, giving us a little gesture. Thank you very much, David. Dr. Alan Chartok is here, the CEO of Northeast Public Radio, a paragon of insight.
I don't know. The governor of New York has rediscovered me. He comes on and he wants to talk to me half an hour every week. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we have not always had the best of relationships. He always calls me doctor. This is his way of dealing with me, doctor, like you just did, doctor. Hmm. And I said, how do you know I'm a doctor? He says, because you're always operating.
Ha ha. <Ba-da-boom>. Kaylin Brown is here, head of the journalism program and the communications department at College of St. Rose. How are you?
I'm well.
You're well so far. Good. Absolutely. And Judy Patrick, who is vice president of the New York Press Association and longtime editor of the Daily Gazette in Schenectady. What's up?
You know, the governor never calls me. You know, I don't think I've ever talked to him. I'm pretty sure I've never talked to him.
And if he did, would you tell us?
I certainly wouldn't. I would have a ton of questions.
Oh, good.
Well, you can call him in to me and I'll ask him for you. I'll say, Judy Patrick wants to ask this question.
You know, the morning after the State of the Union, the president of the United States had a sit down in the Oval Office with a bunch of regional news reporters. That is, people from smaller news organizations. And our reporter, or the Times Union, shares a reporter with the Hearst Connecticut papers. And our reporter is one of the people who got the straw drawn. He was one of the nine reporters who got to come in and talk to the president. So it was kind of one of those situations, Judy, where you think, gee, what happens if I actually get to talk to the guy? What would I say? You know, what would be the questions that I would ask? That kind of thing. So, you know, you get that moment. It's kind of fun.
You would ask a very easy question. Are you mentally stable, Mr. President?
Well,
have you got enough sleep?
Do you get enough sleep? Well, he probably doesn't. Isn't that true? Like you, Alan, he's probably a little bit sleep deprived.
Well, it depends when you go to sleep. I got to sleep at 7 in the evening.
Mm-hmm.
And my grandson, who is 4, always says, why are you going to sleep before me?
Uh-huh. A wise grandson.
There you go. Anyway, very interesting conversation here by taking your opportunities as you can. So while we're talking about the president and the State of the Union, we ought to talk about how you go about covering that sort of thing. Because by its very nature, these kinds of events are difficult to cover because it is just sitting there in front of you. In effect, all you're doing, if you're just using the old version of journalism, is you just parrot back what the person said, right? But that would be irresponsible journalism in the era of Trump.
Well, think about it this way. Nature abhors a vacuum, especially in the time of, I'm already getting a look from Kaylin, especially in the time of Trump, right? If he hasn't tweeted or if there isn't something of the moment, then you go to the next best thing. What we've been watching all this week as we speak is the mess in Virginia, where three people, all Democrats who are at the top, one put on blackface and admitted it, or even worse, a KKK uniform, he's not sure which. One has a sexual harassment claim against him, the lieutenant governor, which seems at least on its face somewhat credible. The Secretary of State, who would come next if the two other guys above him retired or got out, is also back to the blackface thing. But you would think it's the end of the Second World War. I mean, it is every second of every day you go to either Morning Joe in the morning or CNN, that's all you're going to hear. And that has to do with there's nothing competing with it for salacious interest.
Salacious interest is not the purpose of journalism, though, right?
Well, that's in your textbook, Professor.
No, Alan. There's nothing wrong with textbooks, by the way, except for their prices. But the situation in Virginia deserves coverage. It does not probably deserve what we always used to call in the newsroom wretched excess, where the entire newsroom gets allocated to one story.
Nor, by the way, have you seen that anywhere? I have not.
Oh, well.
Have I ever seen wretched excess?
No, in the case of this, Alan is turning the topic to the Virginia thing.
Yes.
So let's talk about that. I have not seen the entire newsrooms turned onto the Virginia story. I think it's an important story, and it is interesting, and there's nothing wrong with covering a story that is intrintsically interesting, right?
Absolutely, and I have not. I have not seen wretched excess,
this is so
but it
typical.
Does exist.
Right. Alan is scolding us for covering the story.
I
think it's important to cover.
I'm not scolding you.
Oh, it's because it's a Democrat, Alan, and you know your bias is there, and so you're ashamed that journalists are covering a scandal that's involving Democrats.
I am. No, on the contrary.
These Democrats blew it.
Well, that's true. And I can only tell you that I think it is a story. I never said anything about you, Rex, although your paper has always been somewhat moderate in the way that you cover, you know, different stuff. I mean, you're not.
Thank you.
You're not all over the place. Rex, I think you may not be with it in that if you turn on CNN or MSNBC, that's all you're going to hear. And that's all you have been hearing for all these days.
Well,
so you
not
are.
True.
Not,
you not are true. Putting, not true at all.
Putting it another way, Rex.
That's not factually
you
accurate.
You are just wrong.
FN.
So,
FN.
To get back to the State of the Union. So did this take away from coverage of the State of the Union? No, it didn't. If you could look at mainstream news websites, the State of the Union and the aftermath of that is still in lead positions. I mean, the Virginia story is so catastrophic for that state. Obviously, it needs to be covered. On the State of the Union, did we cover it accurately? Were people interested? Certainly, because 45 million people watched it on television. Who knows how many people listened to it on the radio? I think it is such a signature part of our democracy for the president to come forward and give a State of the Union. As much as I hate the clapping, it takes forever, and I hate the showmanship involved in it, I think we still need to cover it. I thought the after effect, the commentary from the TV people afterwards, I think was very partisan on both sides. I thought we didn't really get a good sense of what he was really saying that was new, which was probably nothing.
Yeah. One of the analyses points out that it's the most partisan audience. The TV audience, it's a deeply Republican audience, which is why Fox
exactly.
was number one. Yep.
Exactly, because when they did the polling, Rex, afterwards, they found that 70% of the people approved of the president's address.
Yeah.
And, of course, the first question that a pollster is going to ask on the telephone in a quick and dirty is, did you see it?
Mm-hmm.
I think an awful lot of Democrats didn't see it. In
right.
the same way they don't go to Fox. And so, therefore, it was a skewed poll, I believe, to begin with.
Because the numbers are drawn in a large part from an echo chamber.
That's right.
So if it's an echo chamber, you're not going to get any variables.
Yeah. But what I really think is, and I know that I'm going to defy the three of you because you are my enemies in this, my intellectual enemies. And that is when the news people are doing it, especially on the cable channels, they are looking for those things that will, you said partisan before, you're right. And I think they are biased against Trump, although so am I. But when the women in white stood up to applaud, that was played because Trump walked into it and said, well, you know, more women are working now and more women are elected to Congress. And they stood up and they applauded and they yelled and they high-fived each other. That played again and again. Now, it's good TV. On the other hand, it also affirmed what I consider to be their appropriate prejudice.
But aside from the analysis of partisans on cable news, what's hard, I think, is to cover this kind of thing as a reporter. If you're trying to write the account, if you're trying to write the next day's story about something like this, where you have, quite frankly, a president who is, I guess any president tells things as they wish them to be perceived, but this guy has such a record of lying that it's very hard to write a straight news account of it without saying, he lied here and he lied there. And that then plays into the president's narrative that reporters are all out to get him because the reporter's job is to tell the truth, not just to pass along whatever they happen to see. Isn't that right?
It is. It's why the media ethics questions get raised about how do we cover this State of the Union and should there be Chyrons that have all the, or Chyron, that have all the fact-checking right there in front of the viewer, listener, reader, however they can see, so they can see in real time what's happening. Mm-hmm. Journalism needs a lot more investment for that to be a regular occurrence.
And do you remember, guys, when we used to always talk about using the word lies in
right.
the beginning? Nobody wanted to say he was lying, although he was lying. He was a lying liar. But nobody wanted to say that. But
you
now,
did, Alan Shattuck.
I did. I
you
was
said
way
it
of,
all along.
Way out of the pack.
But you also said that this panel are your intellectual enemies, and I don't think that you really mean that.
No, I don't.
You don't want to emulate the president by characterizing the people you're working with.
You turned
enemies,
that around.
Right? Well, it's because we don't. Why would we want to use the same sort of language that we're critical of?
Well, that's why I said intellectual. You see, I didn't say enemies. I said intellectual because I think you guys are almost always apologetic for the media as opposed to being properly critical.
I disagree.
Well, of course you do. That's the whole point. That's exactly proves my point.
But I'm not your enemy.
Yeah, I will raise the point that it hasn't been just this president that the media has checked facts on at State of the Union addresses. This has happened for a long time. It's just that there's a lot more things to draw attention to as lies now than there were before.
Okay, Professor Brown, I have to say this to you. I want to apologize publicly because you certainly aren't my enemy. You're somebody I admire greatly.
But to hell with us.
Oh, now
that's
we
right. Here we are sitting here in the corner.
Well, she's mutual one. Adoration she's, society she's I'm the, not part of. So.
She's the one who called me on it, Judy. So therefore, I thought I would address the apology to her. I just did it to spice things up a bit.
I know.
You know, it's interesting. There are critics of the Trump speech aside from the facts of it. John Alsup in the Columbia Journalism Review said it is, as is increasingly the case with Trump's set piece speeches, the so too lacked dramatic punch. And Ann Coulter, a critic from the right, said this was the lamest, sappiest, most intentionally tear-jerking State of the Union ever. Please fire your speechwriter, Donald Trump. So, you know.
Well, his speechwriters were bad. I admit that. I think there's no question about it, but so is he. His delivery of the speech was terrible.
He doesn't believe what he's saying.
And he's looking into a teleprompter, which a guy who thinks of himself as a control freak doesn't like because it holds him to his thing.
Don't you think, too, there might be the problem? He doesn't do much reading, and so he's not very fluid as he reads a teleprompter because we know that he watches television all the time. That's the executive time.
Well,
that
teleprompter's a little bit like a television.
Well, it's sort of that in-between technology, isn't it?
Well, it's kind of scary. As a matter of fact, for years, almost 30 years, I did television on two networks here almost every night, local networks, and I would look into the teleprompter, and there would be my face.
Ah.
And that was very scary because I would say, what's he looking at me for? And here's the worst part of it. I have an identical twin. So when I was looking into the teleprompter, I was thinking, what's he doing there? Forget it. This is not germane to the discussion.
So in the hours and the last 2 days leading up to the State of the Union, Fox Network was hyping the latest caravan, supposedly, that's coming up to the United States, which is what gives the president some fuel for his fire of claiming that the United States is facing this dramatic challenge on the border. What is difficult is how do you, if you're a journalist and you believe that people ought to pay attention to what is important, if there is an important challenge to America's security, our intelligence agencies, you would think, would make note of it. And the week before the President's State of the Union, all the intelligence chiefs appeared in testimony before Congress, did not mention the southern border as a place they're concerned. It is difficult to draw attention to that which is of consequence, which is where is the real threat to the United States, when instead you have a television network, perhaps, as Alan points out, for ratings purposes, for sensationalism, drawing attention to this diversion to these people coming up, which plays into the president's political point.
You know, we do know one thing, and that is there is a crisis. It's the worst crisis this world has ever seen, period. And that is the crisis on climate.
Mm-hmm.
And very little. In the State of the Union, there was almost nothing about climate change and what we needed to do about that. So, yeah, he sets the agenda for the media. There's no question about it. He sets the agenda. And yet, here is this crisis. The second hottest year in history, I believe, was last year. We're going down, and as the old prophecy goes, not water but fire next time. I think it's unbelievable that he gets away with it and that the media basically has no antidote for that.
Well, there's a proposal that might help, I should say a project. Craig Newmark, he who created Craigslist, is giving $15 million to the pursuit of ethical journalism, which could be one of the answers to this, finding out a way to answer some of these challenges. $10 million going to Columbia Journalism School, $5 million to the Poynter Institute for this kind of work. Kind of ironic that the guy who...
Absolutely, put the newspapers out of business.
Because Craig Newmark is the founder of Craigslist, which is the newest wave, not so new anymore, of classified advertising, with was the essentially structure by which most newspapers finance themselves.
That's right.
Local newspapers have lost billions and billions of dollars with the loss of classified advertising thanks to
Craigslist.
So this
is almost a tip, Judy.
This is a small little tip left on the table.
Well, he already gave $20 million to CUNY, and so now the Graduate School of Journalism at City University of New York is called the Newmark School. Sorry, go ahead, Judy.
Oh, yeah, all right. Yeah. But I'd like to make the point that this money doesn't trickle down to the thousands of local newspapers that have been hurt by these cuts in classified advertising. Let's start giving some of this money out into the trenches, into the grassroots, so we can fund reporters working in newsrooms and instead of think tanks where they're going to come up with ideas like, oh, let's do more video. I'm sorry that that didn't help. I think more money from philanthropic efforts needs to go to the grassroots level. Surely studying ethics is important, but more needs to go to the grassroots.
I agree, and I think many ways to do that involve student journalists. So I think most recently in the last week, Miami again is working, the Miami Herald again is working with student journalists at local journalism schools to deliver actual content in its run of the paper, on its website, to their readership.
To which I say, good luck, Charlie. I mean, yeah. Every time I turn around, somebody is... You're looking at me very strangely.
I don't know where you're going.
That's not infrequent.
Maybe you look very strange.
But I'm saying there are these nice little projects, some of the foundations. Oh, yeah, we got to give $10 million. We got to get $5 million. But really, the overwhelming death of newspapers, in which the Sulzbergers are predicting the death of newspapers, and Judy Patrick is saying, oh, my God, look at what's happened to these newspapers and all of that. Those little tiny drips and drabs, tips on the table, hardly do it.
I don't know how you would allocate money. I love the idea of some of the money going to local newsrooms, but it's going to be hard to convince philanthropists or even ordinary citizens that you ought to direct money to for-profit enterprises like my company. Hearst is a big multimedia giant with 20,000 employees around the world, but the newspaper division doesn't make much money. Even so, how do you say, or even if you talk about a for-profit enterprise like the family-owned Gazette, which you used to edit, still profits go to individuals who own the property. So how do you say, yes, let's allocate either taxpayer dollars or even philanthropic dollars to that?
Yeah, there's one proposal out there in some city somewhere where a charity is donating money to pay for subscriptions for poor neighborhoods. So people who can't afford newspapers will get newspapers on their doorstep. It increases the circulation for the paper, and increases literacy, increases public knowledge of what's happening. I think that's a wonderful approach.
Yeah.
Which sounds similar to the newspaper and education programs that I'm not sure of their status now, but I still do think that newspapers and education is valuable in whatever format it happens. If you get the newspaper into student classrooms at a young level, I think that teachers and students together can figure out the news landscape and where to go with that.
Well, I sure hope you're right, Professor, but I don't think you are. I don't think that's going to make a big difference. I think the newspapers are on a downward spiral, and until they figure out a different mechanism, which is the way that I do it, I read the New York Times twice a night. Get up, read the Times, go back to bed.
Do you have a subscription?
Yeah, and so does my wife, a separate subscription.
So the bottom line is you are paying your hard-earned dollars to get real, reliable journalism from a newspaper.
Yes, but here's the problem.
So you do believe that newspapers are valuable because you read the newspaper twice a day, the Times.
I do, but they've got to find, and all the others also, by the way, but they've got to find a way to finance themselves. And Rex, before he opens his mouth, because I know he will, inevitably.
That's how I breathe.
and he will tell us that making money from the electronic side is not the same as making money the way that it used to on the print side.
It is hard. The Times also is in a class by itself. The Times has a record 4.3 million print and digital subscriptions. That's a jump from around 3 million just 2 years ago.
That's huge.
And the Times is growing. They've just announced they're adding another 120 newsroom employees. They now have 1,600 people in the Times newsroom, an all-time high. So the fact is that has worked. That is, the high-quality journalism there has really made a difference. People are willing to pay for it. People all around the world are willing to pay for it. The question is, what happens in the local communities around all of our cities where it takes so many people to simply put out the product that you don't have enough revenue to support the payroll? I've told the story about talking to an editor in one of the local communities in the Southern Tier who almost tearfully told me on the phone about his staff of five reporters who were remaining from a newsroom that had previously had 30-some people, and how what each of them was doing that day, and how he just didn't know how he was going to get out the next day's paper. So what do you do about that kind of a situation where the revenue isn't there because there aren't enough stores locally? You no longer have brick-and-mortar stores to buy the ads to support the paper. You don't have the classified ads because free advertising, even if Craig Newmark hadn't done that, somebody else would have created free classified advertising. And subscriptions alone have never paid for it. So it is just a difficult challenge. And until we come up with a solution, society is not going to be as well served by the kind of journalism we need as we need it to be.
Right. It's all well and good for the New York Times to grow and add more reporters, but the New York Times is not going to cover the city of Albany's mayoral race. They're not going to cover the Canajoharie Town Board. We need grassroots journalism, and that really needs to be an important focus for our industry.
But as I've said so many times, don't you think if nature abhors a vacuum, and we all agree on that one, that somehow new modalities will arise?
You know, politicians, I think, love a vacuum. They can do whatever they want out there.
No, yeah. That's true. But I'm saying, don't you think that the fact that we're in this kind of dilemma will lead to somebody figuring out, I'll do what I can. There was a local website, which I think is just closed down here in Albany, for example.
That's the point.
I mean, it closed down.
I know that. So I think that the search, my point is, I think the search goes on for other ways to do this. I know we have a local listserv in Great Barrington, where I live, called The Hill, which is the hill that I live on.
Uh-huh.
And people are writing to it all the time with very interesting material, including stuff like schools and other things.
But you lack the skill of trained journalists. I mean, I think you're probably right that in the detritus of ruins
what?
Of
detritus.
The ruins of
you must have gone to a private college.
I'm sorry if it's a little bit over the heads of Hunter College, Alan. I'm sorry. But it's all right. It's in the ruins of the journalism industry as we know it, then maybe something will spring up, but it'll be small and local. And I just worry that a lot of the watchdog reporting that people have depended upon for so long will not get done.
So I think that is exactly why the Washington Post spent so much money in its Super Bowl ad to tell the public in that particularly controversial venue how important journalism is, and to explain to them the reason they know what they know is because of journalism.
It'd be great to know whether that ended up with a bunch of people sitting up and say, as Rex always says, golly gee whiz, Martha, that really did teach me the value of the press.
But God bless journalists, because they always find the negative about everything. There was some complaints about the Washington Post ads and the fact that it could have funded, I think, 10 journalists making $50,000 a year for 10 years. So
there you go.
But it was a decision. Sometimes you have to do some branding.
All right. On that, you folks can talk about this out there and as you go off with the sounds of Pete, we're always going
birthday
to
coming up, 100th birthday coming up.
Isn't that great? Pete. Alan Shartok, Kaylin Brown, Judy Patrick, and Rex Smith, we thank you for joining us this week on The Media Project.
Upon a living stage now, newspapermen are such interesting people. When they know they've got a people's fight to wage, ting-a-ling-a-ling, newspaper guild, got a free new world to build, meet the people, that's a thrill.
The Media Project is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Alan Shartok is CEO of WAMC, professor emeritus at the State University of New York, commentator, columnist, and author. Rex Smith is editor of the Times Union. Kaylin Brown is the chair of the Department of Communications at the College of St. Rose. And Judy Patrick is the vice president for editorial development for the New York Press. Press Association. You can listen to or podcast The Media Project anytime at WAMC.org or just download the WAMC app for your iPhone or Android at the Play Store today. Thanks for listening.
Shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give free cheers for freedom of the press.